situations may give you the most relief. For example, after two tours of duty in Afghanistan, Verge had strong fear reactions to a variety of sounds, including helicopters, sirens, gunshots, and explosions. But it was explosions that caused the most intense fear, which he rated as over 100. He said fireworks were terrifying, so the 4th of July and New Year's Eve were a nightmare of repeated panic attacks for him. Verge chose to focus on overcoming his intense fear of explosions first, so that he could enjoy these holidays with his family. Triggers that arise frequently. Another consideration is how frequently you find yourself in particular anxiety-provoking situations. Completing the anxiety-provoking situations worksheet will help you identify the situations that cause anxiety most often. Reducing the anxiety you feel in frequently occurring situations can greatly improve your quality of life because these situations have a greater impact on your daily life. For example, a postal carrier who works in a residential neighborhood and has a fear of dogs may very well want to choose work on that fear first, since that trigger shows up multiple times on every single workday. Summary. As you can see, the anxiety-provoking situations worksheet is extremely useful for identifying the situations you'd like to target for change. Identifying your triggers in these situations will help you know what you need to teach your amygdala. It isn't necessary to change your reactions to all your triggers. Rather, choose to target triggers in those situations in which your anxiety stands in the way of your personal goals and dreams, those that result in the greatest distress, or those you encounter most frequently. In general, the best way to start is with a situation in which reducing your anxiety would significantly improve your life. In the next chapter, we'll show you how to rewire your amygdala to accomplish this. Chapter 8. Teaching Your Amygdala Through Experience. In the previous chapter, we discussed how the amygdala learns to react to certain triggers with fear or anxiety. Once such a reaction has formed, it's difficult to change the pattern and get the amygdala to stop reacting to the trigger. Although you can't easily erase the emotional memory formed by the amygdala, you can develop new connections in the amygdala that compete with those that lead to fear and anxiety. To get the amygdala to create these new connections, you need to expose it to situations that contradict the association between a trigger and negative event. If you show the amygdala new information that's inconsistent with what it's previously experienced, it will make new connections in response to this information and learn from the new experience. Exposing your amygdala to new information allows you to rewire it in a way that gives you more control over your anxiety. It's similar to adding a bypass of a well-traveled area on a highway. When you create a new neural path and practice traveling it again and again, you establish an alternate route that avoids trouble. Responding with fear and anxiety is no longer your only option. You can establish other, calmer responses as a way around your anxiety. Studies have shown that new learning in the amygdala occurs in the lateral nucleus. So you need to communicate new information to the lateral nucleus if you want to train your amygdala to respond differently. Within the brain, there are relatively few connections from the cortex to the amygdala, and the connections that exist don't communicate directly with the lateral nucleus or the central nucleus. The connections from the cortex seem to send their messages to intercalcated neurons, a collection of nerve cells that lie between the lateral nucleus and the central nucleus. Though these neurons allow the cortex some influence over ongoing responses, the cortex doesn't seem to have direct connections to the lateral nucleus. You need to specifically retrain the amygdala if you want to reduce its influence on your brain, emotions, and behavior. By practicing the exposure techniques described in this chapter, you can communicate new information to the lateral nucleus and rewire the pathways associated with specific triggers. If you think about it, You're surrounded by examples of people who have overcome even what are thought to be naturally inborn fears. For example, in big cities, you can see people suspended from ropes cleaning the windows of tall skyscrapers, apparently quite calm as they go about their day's work. People who participate in water skiing, horseback riding, or ballroom dancing may have had to overcome fears to participate in these activities. Learning to swim or drive often requires people to overcome anxiety. Repeated exposure to a seemingly threatening situation without anything negative occurring can teach the amygdala that the situation doesn't require a fearful response. You can overcome fears if you give your amygdala experiences that teach it to feel safe in related situations. This is the power of exposure. Exposure-based treatment. Among the various types of therapy for anxiety-based difficulties, especially panic attacks, phobias, and obsessive-compulsive disorder, none has been as dramatically successful as exposure therapy. In this approach, people are exposed to situations or objects they fear, sometimes in a gradual way and sometimes more abruptly. During each exposure, anxiety typically rises, often to an uncomfortable level, and then begins to subside. The key is to let the anxiety response run its course, peaking and then lowering without escaping the situation. In this way, the amygdala begins to pair a previously feared situation with safety. The power of exposure therapy lies in giving the amygdala new experiences that prompt it to make new connections. According to psychologist Edna Foa, who has conducted extensive studies of exposure, and colleagues, its effectiveness comes from the corrective information it provides. The learning experiences offered by exposure show the amygdala that triggers that previously evoked fear and anxiety are actually quite safe. Exposure therapy is a highly effective way to speak the language of the amygdala. Systematic desensitization and flooding are two examples of exposure-based treatment. Systematic desensitization involves learning relaxation strategies and approaching feared objects or situations in a gradual manner. Typically, this occurs in a slow but steady process, gradually working through situations that elicit increasingly more anxiety as the therapy proceeds. With flooding, in contrast, people jump right in with the most fear-provoking situation, and the exposure may last for hours. Flooding is a more intense approach, but it also provides relief from anxiety much more quickly. With either approach, in most cases, people initially confront feared situations mentally by imagining themselves in the feared situation. But ultimately, they must directly experience the situation, usually repeatedly. Obviously, this is a challenging form of treatment, but research shows that it's exactly the approach needed to rewire the amygdala. Therefore, the more you practice exposure, the more likely it is that your amygdala will respond calmly to previously feared situations and triggers. You may wonder whether the gradual approach of desensitization or the more rapid approach of flooding is more effective. Research indicates that intense, extended exposure to triggers that produce fear, flooding, is more rapid and effective than a gradual approach. But for an approach to be effective, a person must be willing to use it. Not surprisingly, anxious people tend to be more likely to try a gradual approach, like desensitization, rather than flooding. In the end, either approach works, because ultimately, both allow the amygdala to experience previously feared stimuli without any negative results. Because exposure-based treatments are so effective, they are one of the most frequently recommended approaches to reducing anxiety. Many people who have learned to cope with their anxiety have had personal experiences or professional treatment that involved exposure. If you haven't engaged in exposure-based treatment, we recommend that you seek a professional to guide you through the process, as evidence indicates that the support of a therapist is very helpful. If you've already had exposure therapy, we hope that this book will help you understand why exposure works. And if you've tried exposure therapy and it wasn't effective or lasting, we hope this book will help you understand why. If you give it a try again and follow the approach outlined in this chapter, we believe it will be helpful. Of course, exposure therapy isn't easy. By definition, it produces anxiety because it involves deliberately engaging in anxiety-provoking experiences. Knowing that this process is required to rewire your brain will help you rise to the challenges and make the stress of the experience more tolerable. Nothing speaks to the amygdala more effectively than experiences that activate the neurons associated with feared situations and objects. Your amygdala is constantly monitoring your experiences and creating connections between neurons that indicate what it believes to be safe versus dangerous. Exposure-based treatment gives the amygdala opportunities to make new connections and practice those connections over and over again. The basics of rewiring. Activate to generate. The amygdala must have particular experiences for rewiring to occur. During exposure, you need to experience the sights, sounds, and other stimuli that create anxiety in order to activate the exact neural circuitry that holds the emotional memories you want to modify. Activating these circuits creates the potential to develop new connections between different neurons, connections that will modify the amygdala's responses. Again, you must activate the neurons to generate these connections. You must experience fear or anxiety in order to conquer it. There's more than cowboy wisdom in the old adage, "You gotta get back on the horse that threw you." When people are left to their own devices, the amygdala typically doesn't get the learning experiences it needs to change its responses to feared situations. In fact, the anxiety response often prevents effective exposure from occurring. Consider a grandmother with a fear of flying who receives the gift of an airline ticket for a trip to visit her extended family thousands of miles away. As she contemplates packing for the trip or arrives at the airport to board the plane, her anxiety increases, creating excellent opportunities for exposure. But she doesn't realize that her anxiety means she's in the best position to rewire the activated circuits and change her amygdala's response to the situation. Instead, her most natural reaction to her anxiety in such situations will probably be to try to avoid taking the trip. You can reason with her that flying is safer than driving, and she may understand that or even reason with herself, but her amygdala isn't operating on the basis of reason. It's simply activating established connections that produce a stress response. When facing feared situations, the discomfort can sometimes seem unbearable, and the desire to escape irresistible. Yet if that grandmother avoids taking the flight, she will miss an opportunity for exposure and miss an opportunity to spend time with her family. This dynamic of experiencing anxiety and then escaping it by avoiding the situation just serves to maintain anxiety, and this is exactly what makes anxiety reactions so difficult to modify. In this way, anxiety can be self-perpetuating. To remind yourself why it's necessary to experience anxiety, remember the phrase, "activate to generate." This is what's required for learning to occur in the amygdala. The activation of neurons underlies the effectiveness of exposure-based therapy. If you want to generate new connections, you must activate the circuits that store the memory of the feared object or situation. The emotional arousal and anxiety that occurs is a sign that you're activating the right circuits. In fact, evidence shows that people who have higher levels of emotional arousal benefit most from exposure during initial exposure experiences. This may also explain why flooding works more rapidly than systematic desensitization. Animal research and brain imaging indicate that exposure, the process of experiencing a situation or object that causes anxiety while nothing negative happens, allows another portion of the brain to exert some control over how the amygdala responds. This other portion of the brain lies in the frontal lobes. And research on humans shows that an area called the ventral medial prefrontal cortex seems to be involved. During exposure, learning occurs in the amygdala, and the memory of this learning is stored by the ventral medial prefrontal cortex. The fear learned in and stored by the amygdala isn't erased, but other circuitry is developed, and new, calmer responses are learned. An analogy may help you remember how important it is to activate the circuitry of anxiety, even though this is an uncomfortable experience. When you're making a cup of tea, you'll have better results if the water is hot. Putting tea leaves or a tea bag in a cup of cold water won't be as effective in allowing the flavor of the tea to be infused into the water. In a similar way, your neural circuits need to be activated or hot to make new connections. When it comes to anxiety, you need to be exposed to the heat if you want to rewire your neural circuitry. Understanding exposure through practice in diagramming. Consider the unfortunate experience of a young boy who was scratched by a cat. The cat, a neutral object that became a trigger, is associated with the scratch, a negative event that caused pain. As a result, cats have come to elicit anxiety. Afterward, when the boy sees a cat, he experiences anxiety and isn't at all interested in playing with it. If we want to help him create new circuitry and change his fear of cats, we need to expose him to friendly cats in order to retrain his amygdala. When he sees or touches a cat under positive circumstances, while petting it and enjoying its softness, being amused by its antics, and so on, his amygdala can be stimulated to establish new circuitry related to cats. The more the child observes or interacts with cats in the absence of negative events, the stronger the new neural or positive connections will become and the less anxiety he'll experience. With repeated exposure to friendly cats, the child's amygdala will create a bypass around his fear and anxiety. Of course, during exposure, the child is likely to feel and express fear of the cat. But this exposure is necessary to activate the neurons we wish to rewire. There's no way to change the circuitry the lateral nucleus has created without giving the amygdala new experiences with a cat and, as a consequence, creating some anxiety. In fact, the child's anxiety is a good indication that the correct circuits in the amygdala have been activated and are ready for new learning. Taking the plunge. Exposure is a no-pain, no-gain situation. You must expose yourself to feared situations and allow yourself to experience anxiety if you want to change your response. The optimal condition for learning to take place in the amygdala is when the neurons are excited, just as the optimal condition for building muscle mass in the body is when the muscle fibers are fatigued. In a parallel way, as you do more repetitions, you grow stronger. You can think of exposure as a way of providing exercises that will train your amygdala. We assure you that a great deal of evidence indicates that exposure is a highly effective way of changing the connections in the brain that are responsible for anxiety. Still, it's difficult to deliberately put yourself in a situation designed by its very nature to distress you, and sometimes it's downright impossible. You shouldn't try exposure until you're confident you'll follow through, because it's possible to actually strengthen anxiety if you leave the exposure situation before your anxiety decreases. Because exposure that's done incorrectly can strengthen anxiety, we recommend working with a therapist who's experienced with exposure. This will ensure that you get the best treatment. You also should carefully choose when to use exposure and when not to, so you can utilize this powerful tool to help you gain control over the most important aspects of your life. Use exposure with situations that will have the most impact on your life, and don't put yourself through exposure when changing your fear response isn't necessary. For example, if you don't need to get over a fear of snakes, don't work on that. Exposure won't be terribly distressing in every moment, especially if you choose gradual approaches. And when exposure is quite challenging, you can strengthen your resolve by reminding yourself that you'll experience changes in your anxiety relatively quickly. A good analogy for illustrating the transformative power of exposure is going for a swim. Have you ever dipped your toes into a pool or lake and winced at the cool temperature of the water? As you wade further in, you're aware of the coolness of the water as it gradually reaches your stomach and chest. After a period of time, however, your body adjusts, and you find yourself comfortable in the water. You smile at others who are in just up to their knees and complaining that it's cold. The same process of adjustment occurs with exposure. Your amygdala will adapt if you remain in the situation. When you're practicing exposure exercises and you feel your anxiety decrease, you'll know that you've gotten the amygdala's attention and are making progress. Medication considerations. If you're on anti-anxiety medication, be aware that some medications can assist you in the exposure process, whereas others make it harder for your amygdala to learn. Benzodiazepines, such as Valium, diazepam, Xanax, alprazolam, Ativan, lorazepam, and Klonopin, clonazepam, may interfere with exposure. These drugs have a tranquilizing effect on the amygdala, which helps keep anxiety in check. However, the process of rewiring is based on activating the amygdala and creating anxiety to generate new learning. New learning is less likely to occur in a brain medicated with benzodiazepines. In fact, research has shown that taking benzodiazepines decreases the effectiveness of exposure-based treatment. And multiple studies have found that the people who benefit most from exposure-based therapy aren't taking them. On the other hand, certain medications assist with the process of exposure, including selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, and serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs. The SSRIs include medications such as Zoloft, sertraline, Prozac, fluoxetine, Celexa, citalopram, Lexapro, escitalopram, and Paxil, paroxetine. SNRIs include medications such as Effexor, venlafaxine, Pristiq, desvenlafaxine, and Cymbalta, duloxetine. Research indicates that SSRIs and SNRIs promote growth and change in neurons. Therefore, these medications may make it more likely that brain circuitry can be modified by experience. Of course, it's important that you work with your healthcare providers when making any adjustments to medications. Strengthening new connections. To create new connections most effectively, you must engage in multiple exposures to the triggers that cause your anxiety. Remember, you have to activate the fear circuitry to generate new connections. Repeated exposure will not only form these new connections, but also strengthen the new circuitry so it can override the fear circuitry previously established by the lateral nucleus. So, for example, if you're trying to get over a fear of elevators, the most effective approach is to ride a variety of elevators in different settings. Of course, it's essential that your experiences during exposures be neutral or positive. Continuing with the previous example, make sure your exposures to riding in elevators are uneventful and calm. This doesn't mean the exposures will be anxiety-free, obviously. Remember, courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is acting despite fear. The more you experience anxiety and stay in the situation long enough for your fear to diminish, the stronger the new circuitry will become. Designing exposure exercises. In Chapter 7, you learned how to complete the anxiety-provoking situations worksheet. Select one situation from your worksheet to begin with, keeping in mind the considerations regarding prioritization discussed at the end of Chapter 7. Choosing a situation that keeps you from achieving your goals, a situation that creates a great deal of distress, or a situation that comes up often. Start by reviewing the anxiety-producing triggers in this situation. Again, we recommend working with a doctor or therapist who understands exposure-based treatment and can provide support and guidance. Once you've selected the situation you want to focus on, decide whether you prefer the slow, systematic desensitization approach or want to plunge right in with flooding. In the systematic desensitization approach, you'll take the process step by step in a gradual way, working your way up to the most challenging situations over time. In the flooding approach, you'll begin with some of the most challenging situations and work through them in an intense process. Again, flooding is quicker, but either approach will work. In this chapter, we'll guide you through the systematic desensitization approach helping you break down the process into a hierarchy of steps. However, you can easily use flooding by simply starting with some of the most difficult situations. Creating a hierarchy for exposure. An exposure hierarchy is a rank-ordered list of steps that you'll face sequentially to learn new responses to a specific situation. In a hierarchy, you break down a specific anxiety-provoking situation into smaller components and begin by facing those that are least anxiety-provoking, eventually progressing to those that are more challenging. A woman who fears shopping in a mall will serve as an example. To help her construct her hierarchy, we'd begin by asking her to identify the most stressful behavior that could be required of her. Let's say she responds with going into a crowded store and standing in line until I make a purchase. Then we'd ask her to identify a related behavior that would elicit some anxiety, but that she's fairly confident she could carry out. To that, she might respond, I could drive to the parking lot and find a parking space. To construct her hierarchy, we'll use these as the extremes and fill in intermediate steps between them. We then ask the woman to come up with at least 5 more related behaviors that would provoke anxiety at levels between the 2 extremes. Her list might sound something like this: selecting an item to purchase, holding an item and thinking about purchasing it, walking from the car to the mall entrance, asking a clerk a question about an item, walking around the mall with a supportive friend, feeling nausea due to anxiety in a public place, walking around the mall alone, walking around the mall alone when it's crowded. Next, we ask her to order these behaviors from least to most anxiety-provoking, placing them between the first 2 extremes she identified. A scale of level of anxiety ranging from 1 to 100 is useful for putting items in rank order so that the level of anxiety increases with each step. Sometimes what varies is what the person has to do. For example, this anxious shopper feels more anxiety if she has to purchase something than if she simply has to walk around in the mall. In other cases, the triggers might differ, such as being in a crowd or asking a salesperson a question. Other aspects of the situation that might differ include whether another supportive person is present or physical proximity to a trigger. You would put your own hierarchy steps in order by considering the level of anxiety you'd be likely to experience in each step. Then it's time to start practicing, working from the least anxiety-provoking item to the one that would create the most anxiety. Exposure isn't easy. Again, if possible, find a therapist who specializes in exposure therapy to guide and encourage you through the process. In addition to helping you work through a hierarchy, your therapist may have you do exercises that can help desensitize you to the physical sensations resulting from anxiety, such as heart palpitations, shallow breathing, and lightheadedness. These might include interoceptive exposure, which uses simulations such as vigorous activity, intentional hyperventilation, breathing through a straw, or spinning in a chair to help people become more accustomed to some of the physical symptoms of anxiety. If you have obsessive-compulsive disorder, an exposure hierarchy can also help you learn to resist compulsions. You simply create a similar hierarchy of situations that provoke compulsive behaviors, and then expose yourself to those situations without allowing yourself to perform compulsions in response. So if touching canned goods results in a compulsion to wash your hands, you'd touch canned goods repeatedly without washing your hands. This process is called exposure with response prevention. Practicing exposures. Once you've created a hierarchy, the goal is to eventually accomplish each step, staying in the situation until your anxiety diminishes or the compulsion is reduced. We recommend using deep breathing and other relaxation techniques from Chapter 6 to cope with the anxiety you feel during each session. You need not experience a high level of anxiety for rewiring of the circuits to occur, but if anxiety is high during exposure, this can speed the process of change. During each exposure, it's vital not to leave the situation in fear, as this will strengthen the fear circuitry. You need to stay in the situation until you feel your anxiety decrease, preferably by half. In other words, if you rate your initial anxiety in a situation at 80 on a scale of 1 to 100, don't leave the situation until your anxiety diminishes to 40 or below. Often you can actually feel when the amygdala registers new information and calms down. Your amygdala needs to learn that it's safe and that escape isn't necessary. Remember, this is something you must show the amygdala. It only learns through experience. Exposure to each step must be done repeatedly for change to occur in your amygdala. Typically, each repetition of a specific step is easier than the previous one, but sometimes there are ups and downs. Once you've surmounted the most difficult item on your hierarchy and have accomplished your goal, you can choose another feared situation to work on and approach it in the same way. The more you're limited by your anxiety, the more frequently you'll need to practice exposure in order to regain control of your life. Also, make sure you plan in advance. If you don't schedule your exposures and plan to repeat them, you won't rewire your brain and reduce your anxiety. Finally, we recommend that you reward yourself for your progress each time you surmount a step. You deserve a reward for putting yourself through these difficult exercises. In every exposure session at each step along the way, carefully monitor your thoughts so that your cortex doesn't unnecessarily increase your anxiety by engaging in self-defeating or anxiety-provoking thoughts. You're trying to reduce amygdala-based anxiety, not worsen it with thoughts from the cortex. Stay focused on the step that you're facing, and don't anticipate other situations that are higher on your hierarchy. Helpful hints. When practicing exposure, there are a few things you should refrain from doing. As a reminder, don't leave the situation while your fear is still high. If you flee and then feel relief, you'll teach your amygdala that escape is the answer. This will only increase your anxiety in the future, as your amygdala tries to compel you into escaping again, so resist the urge to flee. Stay in control of your behavior. Don't let anxiety take control of you. As mentioned, it's also important to monitor your cortex for thoughts that may increase your fear. The cortex is capable of making the situation worse by thinking negative thoughts. When you detect self-defeating or anxiety-provoking thoughts, try to substitute helpful coping thoughts, such as these. I expect my fear to rise, but I can manage it. Stay focused on this situation. This is all I have to manage. Keep breathing. This won't last long. Relax my muscles. Let the tension go. I'm activating my fear circuits to change them. I'm taking control. Just stay until the fear decreases. It will decrease if I wait. I must activate to generate. Finally, don't use safety-seeking behaviors which can undermine all of your hard work during exposure. Here are some examples of safety-seeking behaviors to avoid. Having extra medicine available so you can use it in an emergency. Having a safe person present for all of your steps. Carrying lucky charms of various kinds. Holding on to objects. Wearing sunglasses. Sitting in a particular position or location. Talking on a cell phone. Staying near an exit or a bathroom. When you use safety-seeking behaviors, exposure is only partial and doesn't result in the changes in the brain you're seeking. If you do use safety-seeking behavior during some of your steps, make sure to eliminate it in later steps to ensure that all of your hard work during exposure has the desired effect. Summary. In this chapter, you've learned how to rewire your amygdala by activating it in the presence of triggers. You've learned how to use a hierarchy to expose your amygdala to triggers in a gradual manner. The most important element of exposure therapy is practice, practice, practice. The only way the amygdala learns is through experience. At times, it's going to be upsetting, even daunting. But if you really want to overcome your anxiety, you need to do this difficult work. Remember, it's a no-pain, no-gain proposition. Just like having toned abdominal muscles requires doing a lot of sit-ups, Changing fear responses requires that you face feared situations and conquer them, one step at a time. Building a bypass and using it often is the best means of achieving lasting relief from anxiety. Your amygdala can and will change if you're willing to put some time, effort, and courage into challenging your fears and teaching your amygdala new responses. Chapter 9. Exercise and sleep tips for calming amygdala-based anxiety. A variety of neuroimaging studies and neurophysiological experiments have shown that the amygdala can be strongly influenced by both exercise and sleep. Exercise has surprisingly powerful effects on the amygdala, surpassing many anti-anxiety medications in effectiveness. Sleep also has a strong impact on the amygdala's functioning, with lack of sleep leading to heightened anxiety. In this chapter, you'll learn how to make specific changes in your lifestyle that can ease amygdala-based anxiety and also reduce your stress level and improve your psychological health more generally. Using exercise to cope with anxiety. The fight, flight, or freeze response is programmed into the amygdala. Instead of fighting this ancient response, perhaps we should try to work with it at times. If your sympathetic nervous system is activated, you can put it to use as nature intended. Instead of resisting your body's preparations to fight or flee, why not look for opportunities to work with that instinct and utilize your muscles in ways that will decrease the amygdala's activation? Brief periods of aerobic exercise can be very effective in reducing muscle tension. And as you learned in Chapter 6, relaxing your muscles can help ease anxiety. If you run or walk briskly when you feel anxious, you'll make use of muscles that have been prepared for action. This will lower levels of adrenaline and use up glucose released into the bloodstream by the stress response. And after you exercise, you'll experience substantial, long-lasting muscle relaxation. In the sections that follow, we'll examine some of the effects of exercise on the body and brain to help illuminate why exercise is such a useful strategy in coping with anxiety. Effects of exercise on the body. The type of exercise that will be most helpful for easing the reactions of the SNS is aerobic exercise, which makes use of large muscle groups in rhythmic movements at a moderate level of intensity. Common forms of aerobic exercise include running, walking, cycling, swimming, and even dancing. In addition, adhering to a regular exercise program can reduce SNS activation more generally, including decreasing its impact on blood pressure and heart rate. This helps counter the symptoms of an activated amygdala. Of course, exercise has many other benefits for the body. For example, aerobic exercise tends to increase a person's metabolic rate and energy level. So if you use exercise to help you cope with anxiety, you'll get a windfall of extra benefits. If you haven't been exercising regularly, please do consider potential risks. Consult your doctor before you begin and increase your activity level gradually, not all at once. Bear in mind that some forms of exercise, such as jogging, are high-impact activities that can lead to a variety of injuries. However, don't let a lack of experience discourage you, because almost anyone can do simple forms of exercise, such as walking, without much difficulty or risk. Exercise and anxiety. We highly recommend exercise as a strategy for reducing anxiety because, quite simply, it works. A variety of studies have demonstrated that aerobic exercise can ease anxiety. Reductions in anxiety are measurable after only 20 minutes of exercise. That's less time than it takes for most medications to begin working. The reduction in anxiety is greatest for people who have higher levels of anxiety to begin with. Furthermore, exercise is helpful for people who are sensitive to the symptoms of anxiety, such as increased heart rate or breathlessness, because those sensations are also associated with exercise. Therefore, exercise can serve as a form of exposure that decreases people's discomfort about those sensations. Generally, exercise results in decreased muscle tension for at least an hour and a half afterward, and reductions in anxiety last from 4 to 6 hours. If you consider that 20 minutes of sustained exercise may result in hours of relief from tension and anxiety, the benefits are clear. In fact, if you anticipate that a particular event or phase of your day may amp up your anxiety, a carefully timed exercise routine may allow you to get through it with less anxiety. In other words, you may be able to achieve a tranquilizing effect without taking tranquilizers. Consider Allie, a 17-year-old who was anxious about an upcoming family reunion in her family's home. Her difficulties with social anxiety made the event seem like a nightmare for her, and she feared feeling trapped. When her therapist suggested that she go for a run if she began to feel panicky during the reunion, Allie literally rolled her eyes. But on the day of the reunion, she tried it. In her words, "mostly because I just wanted to get out of there." After a brief run around the neighborhood, she came back into the house with a feeling of relief that surprised her. She was able to talk to her aunts and uncles without anxiety, and later said, "I really believe that my amygdala thought I had escaped from the danger, and it calmed down." She was sold on the anxiety-reducing benefits of exercise from that day forward. Exercise doesn't just reduce anxiety in the moment or for a few hours afterward. Research shows that following a regular exercise program for at least 10 weeks can reduce people's general level of anxiety. Effects of exercise on the brain. The finding that exercise reduces anxiety has led to research into what's happening in the brain to account for this. You're probably familiar with a runner's high, in which people feel a sense of euphoria after crossing a certain threshold of exertion. Extended or intense aerobic workouts have been shown to cause the release of endorphins into the bloodstream, and these neurotransmitters have been proposed as the cause of that feeling of exhilaration. Endorphin is a shortened name for endogenous morphine, meaning morphine-like substances produced naturally in the body. And as that suggests, these compounds can reduce pain and produce a sense of well-being through their effects on the brain. Animal studies have helped illuminate what may be happening in the brain after exercise. When laboratory rats are offered free access to a running wheel, they generally make use of it. What's more, the level of endorphins in their brains increases and remains elevated for many hours afterward, only returning to typical levels after about 96 hours. This finding indicates, once again, that the effects of exercise on the brain last much longer than duration of the exercise period, and may in fact persist for days. It's quite possible that when you exercise, you're raising your endorphin level not just for that day, but for days afterward. Effects of exercise on the amygdala. Additional research involving rats running on their wheels has shown that exercise changes the chemistry of the amygdala, including altered levels of the neurotransmitters norepinephrine and serotonin. Exercise appears to affect a certain type of serotonin receptor that's found in large numbers in the lateral nucleus of the amygdala. Regular exercise seems to make these receptors less active, resulting in a calmer amygdala that's less likely to create an anxiety response. This calming effect on the amygdala after regular exercise has been found in humans, as well as in mice and rats. Effects of exercise on other parts of the brain. Scientists were surprised when they first discovered that exercise could promote brain cell growth in rodents. 20 years ago, new cell growth in the brain wasn't considered possible. Now researchers know that regularly running on wheels increases the levels of certain neurotransmitters and promotes new cell growth in rats. Research also confirms that exercise promotes factors that stimulate cell growth in human brains, strengthening the evidence for neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change. Scientists have learned that simply exercising can increase levels of neurotransmitters and promote the growth of new cells in the human brain. Exercise produces changes that affect the cortex, as well as the amygdala. Endorphins have effects in the cortex, and changes in the levels of these and other neurotransmitters affect a variety of regions in the brain. Exercise also produces a protein, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that promotes growth of neurons in the brain, particularly in the cortex and hippocampus. In addition, neuroimaging studies of activity in the brain indicate that exercise tends to modify activation of certain areas of the cortex. For example, after running on a treadmill for 30 minutes, men showed greater activation in the left frontal cortex compared to the right frontal area. Greater left frontal activation has been associated with a more positive mood, suggesting that exercise can stimulate the cortex in a manner that produces more positive feelings. Those positive feelings are likely to help reduce anxiety. Considering what type of exercise is best for you. The best type of exercise for you, both physically and mentally, is exercise that meets the following four criteria. You enjoy doing it. You'll keep doing it. It's moderately intense. Your doctor approves it. This means you should choose one or two types of exercise to engage in at least 3 times a week for 30 minutes each time. Whatever you choose, remember that getting your heart pumping and your blood flowing has many benefits. Once you feel the improvement in your mood and reductions in your overall stress level, you should find it easier to stick with an exercise program. Exercise. Assessing your exercise quotient. This brief exercise will help you assess your current exercise patterns and strengthen your commitment to a regular, long-term program of physical activity. Take some time to consider all of the following questions. How often do you exercise each week, and how long does each period of exercise last? Do you feel less anxious after exercise? If you don't exercise regularly, would you consider beginning an exercise program to decrease the SNS activation that anxiety creates? Which type of exercise most appeals to you? Sleep, an active time for the brain. Most people know how much more refreshed and alert they feel when they've gotten a good night's sleep, but few truly grasp how important sleep is for the brain. People tend to see sleep as a period in which the brain shuts down. But sleep is actually a very active time for the brain. Just like your heart or immune system, your brain continues to work while you sleep. And in fact, during certain periods of sleep, it's more active than at any time when you're awake. As you sleep, your brain is busy making sure that hormones are released, needed neurochemicals are produced, and memories are stored. Yet getting good, restful sleep is often a challenge for people who struggle with anxiety. When anxiety interferes with sleep, it's due to the influence of the amygdala. By promoting activation of the SNS, the amygdala can keep you in an alert state that prevents you from cycling down into deep sleep. Worries produced in the cortex can compound the problem by exposing you to distressing thoughts that contribute to the amygdala's activation of the SNS. Worse, if you don't take steps to ensure that you get good sleep, you run the risk of making your anxiety even worse, since a lack of sleep can make the amygdala prone to more anxious responding. Sleep difficulties. If you have difficulty falling asleep or awaken before you need to and can't get back to sleep, it's important for you to read this section. Many people are unaware that sleepless nights have detrimental effects on their health, their brain, and specifically the amygdala. Don't assume that you're getting enough sleep if you don't feel tired. When you're sleep deprived, you can still feel alert or even energetic in stimulating situations. And because anxious people are often in an alert state, with an activated SNS, they may not feel sleepy and therefore assume that they aren't sleep deprived. It may be that they are and just don't recognize it. Be aware that sleep deprivation can show up in many forms, including increased anxiety or irritability, difficulty concentrating, or lack of motivation. Exercise. Assessing whether sleep difficulties are an issue for you. To help you determine whether you have sleep problems, listen to the statements below and write down any that are true for you. I'm often restless and find it difficult to fall asleep when I go to bed. I've used medications or alcohol to help me sleep. I need complete silence to sleep. Any noise will prevent me from relaxing. It often takes me more than 20 minutes to fall asleep. I often feel drowsy, fall asleep, or nap during the day. I don't go to bed or wake up at a consistent time. I awaken too early and can't get back to sleep. I don't sleep soundly. I just can't relax. When I get out of bed in the morning, I don't feel rested. I dread trying to go to sleep at night. I depend on caffeine to get me through the day. The more of these statements apply to you, the more likely it is that you have sleep debt. Sleep debt occurs when people haven't been getting as much sleep as they need, and the hours of missed sleep start accumulating. Most adults need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep per night. Each night you miss an hour or so of sleep, your debt grows. So even if you get enough sleep on a given night, you may still feel sleepy or irritable the next day as a result of an accumulated sleep debt. Lack of sleep and the amygdala. Poor sleep has detrimental effects on the human brain. People who don't get enough sleep have difficulty concentrating, problems with memory, and poorer health in general. But in this chapter, we're particularly interested in how lack of sleep affects the amygdala. So let's take a look at what research into this question reveals. Studies have shown that the amygdala reacts more negatively to a lack of sleep than other parts of the brain. In one study, a group of people was kept from sleeping for one night, and another group was allowed to sleep normally. Then, at about 5 p.m., all were brought into a laboratory and shown a variety of images, both positive and negative, while scientists use functional magnetic resonance imaging to observe how their amygdalas reacted. The sleep-deprived people, who had gone approximately 35 hours without sleep, had about 60% more amygdala activation in response to the negative images. So be aware that if you're going without sleep, you're making it more likely that your amygdala will be reactive and cause you to experience anxiety or other emotional reactions such as anger and irritability. When we sleep, we go through different stages of sleep in a particular pattern. We cycle through these different stages in a repetitive manner, with rapid eye movement, REM sleep, typically occurring several times over the course of the night. REM, or REM sleep, is the stage of sleep during which dreaming occurs. It's also a time when memories are consolidated and neurotransmitters are replenished. Researchers have found that lower reactivity in the amygdala is associated with getting more REM sleep. This suggests that getting good sleep, especially sufficient REM sleep, can help calm the amygdala. As you work on getting adequate sleep, it's important to understand when REM sleep occurs. REM sleep occurs later in the sleep cycle, and phases of REM sleep become more frequent at the end of the overall sleep period. Many people don't realize that a long period of sleep is necessary for getting into these stages of REM sleep. Therefore, 4 hours of sleep followed by an hour of wakefulness, and then another 4 hours of sleep, isn't equal to 8 hours of sleep. When you return to sleep after being awake for even just half an hour, the sleep cycles start over from the beginning, so it will take many more hours to get through an entire sleep period. It isn't like returning to watching a movie where you left off. It's like having to go through the whole movie again from the beginning. Coping with sleep difficulties. After listening to this information about sleep, you may be thinking, I want to get a good sleep, but it isn't easy. Of course, our current 24-hour culture with media, shopping, and restaurants available at all hours can keep us from getting sufficient sleep on a regular basis. Certain stages of life also make one vulnerable to sleep deprivation, including the college years or the first months of parenthood. Many people treat sleep as a luxury that can be disregarded when necessary. To calm anxiety, you need to resist influences that interfere with sleep. However, anxiety itself often impairs people's ability to sleep, with difficulty falling asleep or early awakening both being quite common. When coping with these difficulties, it's useful to know which approaches will help and which will actually worsen the problem. The best approach to improving sleep is to take a careful look at your sleep-related routines to make sure that they're healthy. The following sleep practices can really assist you in achieving a good night's sleep. Before you go to bed, practice a routine set of relaxing rituals. Eliminate light stimulation for at least an hour before bed. Exercise during the day. Establish a consistent bedtime and waking time. Avoid napping. Near bedtime, replace activating thoughts with relaxing ones. If worries haunt you at bedtime, schedule a worry time during the day. Ensure that your sleeping environment is conducive to sleep. Avoid caffeine, alcohol, and spicy foods in the late afternoon and evening. Use relaxing breathing techniques to prepare for sleep. If you can't fall asleep after 30 minutes in bed, get up and do something relaxing. Use your bed primarily for sleep. Avoid using sleep aids. These suggestions are all examples of good sleep hygiene. For more details on good sleep practices, visit www.newharbinger.com/31137. Summary. Clearly, lifestyle habits can have a strong influence on your amygdala. If you engage in regular aerobic exercise, especially exercise that uses large muscle groups, the positive effects on both your amygdala and your cortex can help improve your mood. Exercise also increases neuroplasticity, making both your amygdala and your cortex more responsive to the rewiring you're attempting to achieve. In addition, ensuring that you're getting sufficient good quality sleep can calm the amygdala and make it less reactive to whatever you experience in your daily life, processing the stresses you experience in a more calming way. Throughout Part 2 of the book, you've learned many techniques for influencing the circuitry in your amygdala and keeping it calm. Now it's time to turn to the cortex, which is also capable of initiating, exacerbating, or reducing anxiety. As you've seen in this chapter, when it comes to reducing anxiety, exercise and sleep can benefit both the cortex and the amygdala. In Part 3 of the book, we'll take a close look at other ways to take control of your cortex-based anxiety. Part 3. Taking control of your cortex-based anxiety. Chapter 10. Thinking patterns that cause anxiety. People tend to treat their emotions as though they have no control over them. But as you're learning, you can influence the underlying neurological processes that give rise to anxiety. In Part 2 of the book, we took an in-depth look at how to influence and rewire the amygdala. Here in Part 3, we'll do the same for the cortex. It is possible to change the thoughts, images, and behaviors produced by the cortex, and you can do so in ways that will give you more control over cortex-based anxiety. Many people are familiar with the idea of using thoughts to control anxiety, having learned about this approach either from therapists or by reading about how thoughts or cognitions contribute to creating anxiety. Many more resources are available to assist people in using cortex-based approaches than amygdala-based approaches. For now, it's essential that you understand how different approaches can help you rewire your cortex, so you'll know what you want to accomplish when using these techniques. Our goal is not to explain every cortex-based approach in detail, but to show you how these strategies contribute to the process of rewiring your cortex to ease anxiety in lasting ways. As mentioned in the introduction, cognition is the psychological term for cortex processes that most people refer to as thinking. Perhaps the best-known pioneers of cognitive treatment are psychiatrist Aaron Beck and psychologist Albert Ellis, who each proposed that anxiety can be created or worsened by certain types of thinking. Both suggested that anxiety results from the way people interpret events and sometimes distort reality as a result of certain thinking processes, For example, you may overemphasize the dangerousness of a situation, such as fearing a plane crash despite the overall safety of air travel. Or you may interpret someone else's behavior as being personally relevant when it has nothing to do with you, such as assuming that someone is talking during your presentation because you're boring. Cognitions can cause us to anticipate problems that will never occur or worry about bodily sensations.